This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Funimation and their latest feature, Evangelion 1.01. You're not alone. The movie is the complete rebuild of the groundbreaking sci-fi giant robot anime. Imagine having Dr. Frankenstein as your father. Your classmate and fellow pilot is a partial clone of your dead mother, and she's hot. You've been forced by your father to pilot a giant living robot named Ava Unit 01 to fight deadly creatures called angels from destroying the planet. And to top it off, you have raging teenage hormones, and it's the end of the world if you screw up. No pressure. Otaku USA Magazine writes that Evangelion reminds us of what anime can be by having us flex all our okaru muscles, yet always satisfies our basis needs for cute girls and mecha. You can watch the first 8 minutes of the movie online at Funimation.com/EVANGELION. That's Funimation.com/Evangelion. Evangelion 1.01, You're Not Alone. It's available now on DVD. In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today it's a Word Balloon University episode as we take a look at the film genre of stories adapted from comic books. From the IFC Film Channel, we have film critic Matt Singer joining us. Matt's a longtime comics fan and a podcast host himself of the IFC News Podcast. And today we're just taking a general look at the idea of films based on comic books. Films going back to the film Blade with Wesley Snipes up to the present. Now, we're going to talk about a lot of films that are obviously on your minds. We're probably going to miss a few as well. And I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on our discussion. So after the show, make sure that you either leave me a comment at wordballoon.com, email me, or also you can just leave a word at the Word Balloon message board as well at wordballoon.com. It's been more than 10 years and more than 50 films since the comic book films have resurged, starting with Blade back in 1998, and I thought Matt would be the perfect guy to have a discussion with. We try and figure out who are some of the standout filmmakers and film failures. Plus, we dig back beyond the last 11 years to talk about some of the hidden gems of comic book-inspired films throughout the decades. How long have you been with IFC?
How long have I been with IFC now? I started, I was an intern first.
Okay.
I worked on their website as an intern, ironically enough. And then I got this job in, August of 2005. So been doing this for, 4 years now, I guess?
Cool. People will know you, of course, from your segment as well on At the Movies, but also IFC News, both the podcast and on air. Every now and then we see you doing video interviews in between the movies.
Yeah, mostly, mostly on-air stuff is mostly from festivals. So we go to Sundance, and we go to Cannes, and we go to South by Southwest. We have done Comic-Con, I guess, all 4 years that I've been doing it. So I'm no stranger to Comic-Con, and that's always really, really fun for me just because I am such a big comic book fan. So
let's start there, because that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about right after Comic-Con. It seems like each year, and even I heard you have an IFC podcast kind of about this same topic, that it seems like every year it's become more and more of the media show, which I guess it's always been. But, comic books seem to be falling further and further down on the list, and it really is kind of the San Diego media show with comics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first year we were there would have been, 2006.
Okay.
And I remember we were there and covering it, and there was, the way that works for, if you're doing TV stuff is, the huge convention floor, which I'm sure you know very well, and then upstairs, I don't know if you've ever been in any of these rooms, they have all these rooms upstairs where they do these sort of red carpets, or I guess if you're, if you can get a spot, they do one-on-one interviews with all the talent that's there in Hall H, the big hall.
Yes.
And the first year we went, these red carpets we would do, it would be the local San Diego crews, a couple of websites, and we would be one of, two or three networks that were there, or TV shows that were there. There might be MTV, and I think even G4 was there the first year, but that was about it. And it's gotten to the point now, last year, where we are getting kicked off of red carpets because there's no room, because every TV show and every TV channel under the sun is now there because it is such a huge media event, and especially for movies, it is the amount of talent that Comic-Con draws is really kind of unprecedented. I mean, we go to all those film festivals, we cover all these films, and, you know, we want to cover the little films, and we also want to cover films that have some stars in them and get some interviews with, you know, stars people are going to recognize.
Sure.
And at this point, Comic-Con is, like, the event of the year where you get the most. It's, like, unbelievable how many stars are there now, and you're there, so you can, you know, you can speak to it yourself. I mean, it's just unbelievable how many huge movie stars are there that sometimes wouldn't even show up for the junkets for their own movie, but they come to Comic-Con to prostrate themselves before the geek throng, because, you know, it does really matter for a lot of these movies to get these people on your side, you know.
Yeah.
To win them over, to get the buzz started early. So they are all there, and it's gotten to the point now where it's really tough to cover. The first year we went, it was amazing. We got all these incredible interviews, and now it's to the point where it's still great, but it's tougher because there's so many people there.
Well, and it's comforting to hear that IFC is having the same problems that I am as an individual, because, yeah, you're right. I mean, the pool has gotten crowded, and also what I don't like is they've always shown, you know, a segment or selected scenes of advanced scenes of films, and, you know, you get this montage that, you know, are the best moments so far captured on film. And it really is kind of, and I may have said this to you in an email, and I know I've said this to other people as well, it reminds me of the auto show when you go and see a concept car.
You haven't said that to me, but yeah, I mean, it's a convention. It is a, it's a sales convention. And that is, you know, I've thought about this myself, and the reason that I would wager that the stars do love to come is, like you said, almost without exception, these are movies that are unfinished, right? The movies that are there are the movies that are going to be playing between, you know, basically until the next Comic-Con. All the movies that are comic book, sci-fi, horror, anything that's in that world between this Comic-Con and the next Comic-Con, those are the movies that are going to be there. If you've already opened, there's no point to be there, right?
Yep.
Because people want to see all, like, the sneak footage. They want to be the first. So a big part of the draw of Comic-Con is I was the first to see the footage from Avatar or whatever it is. And so the thing is, the people that are doing these interviews, like myself, who are up on these red carpets, they haven't seen anything from their movie. So it's not like, you know, if you go to a junket, you can love the movie, and that's swell, but you might see the movie and then hate it and then have to do the junket. And, you know, like, and sometimes, you know, the star can feel that. Maybe the star hates the movie, you know what I mean? Like, you never know. That can happen. I've seen it happen. So at Comic-Con, almost every movie is, you know, there's excitement about it. You know, like, once in a while you'll have a movie that falls flat on its face at Comic-Con. But this is where people are really excited to see it, and also where no one has seen it yet. So you're not going to get hardball questions. You're not going to get arguments. You're going to get people who want to they want to know the scoop about your movie. So it's a kind of an easier interview for a star, too.
Sure, and for the filmmakers, for that matter.
Yeah.
And that kind of brings me to what we want to talk about today, and that's, you know, I kind of cite the modern era of comic book films starting with Blade, because it seems like that was, you know, one of the first, even though I think X-Men might have been the first huge blockbuster, I think Blade was a good place to start, where there weren't a lot of expectations for the film, and it was a surprise hit. And I don't know if it necessarily grossed $100 million that year, but I know it came close and did pretty significantly well, certainly compared to the budget. So, you know, we're over a decade now of the modern age with comic book films, and what do you think now, you know, 10 or 11 years down the line? I think the genre is bomb-proof in terms of, I think there will always be some form of comic book films. Maybe you disagree. Tell me.
You know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I at a certain point, I thought, well, this is going to peak. You know, like you said, we've been going now in this, what you've called, and I hadn't thought about it this way, but I think there's probably some truth to it, this sort of modern age of comic book films, as you put it, and I think starting it with Blade is probably a good place to put it. Did you see Blade in the theater? I wonder. I was curious, like, what your reaction was, and did you think at the time, "Wow, this is something different than the comic book movies I'm used to seeing"? And I wonder, from these humble beginnings, because I've heard people use that as sort of the marker, and I wonder if you personally, when you saw it, had any sort of inkling of what was going to happen from there.
I had no inkling of what would come afterwards, but I did feel like, wow, after, you know, the misfires from Batman and Robin to Steel and Tank Girl and so many of these crappy films, that it was, and I really went in with no expectations,
just being a kid who grew up reading Tomb of Dracula and was excited that Blade was getting his own movie, and I'm like, oh, this should work. And and then it did, and it had that energy of a modern action film, and the changes that they made to the character weren't insulting, for a lack of a better word. So it seemed like, you know, there finally was this kind of marriage between, you know, doing a not serious, but you know what I mean, kind of the non-parody comic book films that, you know, I guess started with Batman and really, you know, didn't really end until, like I said, until really Blade and then X-Men after it. So it was nice to see.
Yeah, we didn't plan on sort of like making all these different kind of eras, but I do think that it is, there was sort of like, I almost feel like the 90s were a different era unto themselves, right?
Yes.
With Batman, which was so huge and then so influential. You know, I was looking back at some of the movies that came right after Batman, and it's amazing how many of them sound like Batman and how many have like Danny Elfman scores and how many have that look. They don't take place in real cities. They all take place in made up cities that all sort of look like the Gotham City of the Tim Burton Batman movies.
Sure.
But then, yeah, it's like by 1997, you have Batman and Robin. And clearly that was, I think you can sort of see that as like a demarcation line. Like that was the end point of that. It had gotten to such a point where so many people had copied it and kind of riffed on it and then started to parody it. And then, you know, the snake was eating its own tail and stuff. And by the end, I mean, Batman and Robin is such a, such an abomination, but an enjoyable one for me. But it really didn't. You know, it's like you can't make another Batman movie from there, really, without, I don't know, just making it an actual comedy with, I don't know, musical numbers or something. But yeah, I did see Blade in the theater. I just looked it up. Blade made $70 million, so it's not like the hugest hit in the world. But I think it was definitely. I remember it being sort of like a surprise hit. You know, where it was. You know, it was a Wesley Snipes movie and those sorts of movies. Not just him, but like those sort of like mid-level action stars.
Yes.
You know, it sort of broke through that ceiling that a lot of those guys, you know, you might want to put like a Jean-Claude Van Damme in that world, you know, where their movies sort of have a peak. And Blade was one of those movies that broke through it. And then Blade 2 did even better than the first one. Because when you said you wanted to talk about sort of this era of comic book movies, I tried to put together a list, right?
Okay.
The way I figured it, there's been basically, counting like the big movies, you know, the ones that got theatrical releases, not counting like, you know, direct-to-DVD or
right.
TV movies or whatever, I counted like 54 comic book movies.
Wow.
Since 1998.
Okay.
Not just superheroes, you know, if it's based on a comic book, any sort of graphic novel.
Sure. Ghost World, History of Violence, Road to Perdition. Sure.
Right, exactly. I counted all of those.
Okay.
I'm sure I missed a couple. But yeah, the thing that I wonder, though, is because Blade's 98, but you don't really start to see a big kind of more than like one or two a year until 2001 when you have four, but none of them are sort of name brand superheroes. 2001, I have From Hell, Ghost World, the classic Josie and the Pussycats, and... and Monkey Bone. I could swear that Brian Michael Bendis is a big Josie and the Pussycats fan. I seem to remember.
I remember that. You're absolutely right. He was at the time.
I used to spend a lot of time on his message boards in my youth, and I seem to remember him defending that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Why, I don't know, but he did. So, but anyway, so that's, you know, but it's not until 2002 where we get Spider-Man. And I wonder,
right. And
X-Men is 2000.
Okay.
And that's the only one that year that I could think of, I could find looking around. And I wonder, I think you're right. I think Blade is almost like maybe Blade is the prologue and then X-Men is the first chapter. I wonder if that's maybe how you could define it. Because
it seems like
X-Men 2 is one where, you know, the characters had some more name recognition, whereas Blade, I don't, you know, I mean, you know who Blade is. I know who Blade is. But I don't, you know, I don't know how much of the general public knew about Blade before the movie came out.
I agree.
Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Almost in the same way of Iron Man. I mean, I think more people knew Iron Man, but I feel like a lot of people talked about Iron Man that way. Everyone always talked about, well, Iron Man's not that big of a character before the movie came out. And then the movie came out and everyone's like, Iron Man is amazing.
You're right. You're absolutely.
Yeah.
And clearly that was, you know, from the stockholders meetings, that was the... one of the main reasons they cited as why Disney wanted Marvel. They took a character that wasn't a household name And, you know, really, if it hadn't been for The Dark Knight, Iron Man would have been the story of last year.
Right, right, absolutely.
So, yeah, and and you're right, I do see Blade in that way, because it seems like that's when Avi Arad and Marvel really were able to kind of first, you know, kind of stretch their muscles and figure out how they wanted to, you know, translate these comic book characters into a film. They'd played with TV, but this was, you know, the first movie that they really, it seemed, were able to do on their own terms, if not completely on their own terms, at least with a lot of input.
Right, right. Well, I just wonder, though, because it's like, you would think within a couple of years you would start to see more movies pop up, but it feels, looking at the list that I looked at, it just, or I put together, there I couldn't find a real definitive list, so I sort of made my own.
Okay.
But it just seemed like they seemed to follow X-Men a little bit more. But I certainly agree that Blade was kind of some sort of important touchstone. Because, like you said, it took itself seriously. Whereas we had gotten to a point where with Batman and Robin the year before, you have, you know, taking nothing seriously. You know, it was just complete camp. So Blade obviously was a different story. And I also just remember that it was visually interesting. I remember the way that that Blade would kill all the vampires, that they sort of, they would turn to sort of like ash and cinder, you know?
Yep.
And this feeling like that it had more going to it than just, you know, a guy in a costume or funny gadgets and stuff. It had sort of like a visual style to it. It had some ideas to it beyond just, well, we're going to make a movie with about a superhero. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And then, you know, now then we had, you know, Sam Raimi and Spider-Man, and you had Bryan Singer with X-Men. And I guess they, you know, certainly based on box office success, seem to know, you know, what they're doing. But have the genre auteurs emerged? I mean, are there guys that we can look at now in the comic book film genre and say, oh, if he's directing a film, it's likely to be, you know, a success? I mean, have enough guys put a couple movies together? I can think of a couple names, and I'm curious if you would agree or see some differences.
Well, it's an interesting question, and we were talking about it. I was sort of, you know, asking you more about this kind of thing before we started recording, and you know, you threw out some names, and what I thought was interesting was, so you were saying to me sort of, you were asking almost like, who is going to be like the John Ford? You know, John Ford is to Westerns as blank is to comic book movies.
Exactly.
Am I right? Like, that was, yeah, it's a really interesting sort of world or question to ask. I hadn't really thought about it before you kind of proposed it. And I don't know if there's one particular person at this point. I mean, I guess Sam Raimi might be the most obvious. Although, I mean, for me, coming from a background where I love comic books and I love movies, I knew who Sam Raimi was well before he made Spider-Man. He had an identity to me as a filmmaker, you know, well before he was the guy who made Spider-Man. I was excited when I heard that he was going to make Spider-Man, because I was like, oh, I love Sam Raimi. This is a great matchup of sort of filmmaker and subject. Now, though, that he's made three of them and they were all such huge hits, I think that he certainly is identified with the genre at the very least. The thing is, though, I don't know that any of these filmmakers, and there's other ones, obviously Christopher Nolan is a guy.
Yep.
And I think Zack Snyder is probably another one who, maybe even more than the other guys, because the movies we think of when we think of him are almost, you know, solely comic book movies.
Whereas, that's true.
You know, Nolan has Memento and, you know, The Prestige.
Yes.
And Raimi has all the Evil Dead movies, and just this year, Drag Me to Hell, which I really loved.
Okay.
You know, so they have other sort of things that we know them for, whereas with Zack Snyder, I immediately think of 300 and Watchmen, right? I mean, he did Dawn of the Dead, but I feel like he's really sort of making his identity in that world, whereas the other guys maybe were a little more established.
I agree.
In the case of Raimi, probably more established than Nolan. But the thing is, though, the thing that's interesting about the question is, like, you're right. It's like John Ford, like, stands for the Western, even though there's so many other Western directors we could name, you know, like Howard Hawks.
Certainly.
And on down the line.
Peckinpah, if you want a more modern guy, sure.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, he sort of... he kind of has, when we say that name, we can almost like envision what the movie looks like.
Exactly.
And it's the same way with like, you know, like a guy like Hitchcock, where their names almost become like genres unto themselves.
Yes,
indeed. When you say that it's a Hitchcock movie, that means something, or it's a John Ford movie, it means something. We know, we see enough of his movies, we know exactly what we're going to get, or we have some idea. And I don't know that we necessarily are there with any of these guys yet. You know, like, I don't, like, when you say, oh, it's a Christopher Nolan movie, I'm going to be excited to see it. I think he's a fabulous filmmaker. I don't know that I immediately know, well, it's going to have this or this or this. I was trying today to think of, like, what all of his movies have in common, not just the Batman movies, but looking at Memento or, you know, The Prestige. And I was coming up with some things, but I don't know that he has a real sort of specific, directorial kind of signature yet that I can really pinpoint. Maybe you can for me. Help me out here.
No, honestly, I didn't know if there was an answer to this question, but I just was wondering, and I'm glad you're thinking along the same lines as I am in terms of signature style or something that the director himself brings. Because the other side of the coin is maybe they aren't auteurs, and maybe instead it really is this collaborative group process more than ever because of the effects involved. And because it really has to be this kind of group effort to, you know, put together this kind of blockbuster film, that effects are just as important as acting. And the technical side is so important, as well as, you know, what the actors and director can bring to the screen.
Yeah, it's tough to say because obviously, I mean, for me personally, a lot of my favorite comic book movies are the ones that have the strong directors, the directors that are, you know, like the Sam Raimis, the Christopher Nolans. But on the other hand, we can probably think of examples where there are movies that are made by strong directors who, for whatever reason, you know, didn't make the best comic book movie. You know, the example that springs to mind, and maybe you'll disagree with me, and it's not a movie that I hate the way some people really kind of trash on it, is Ang Lee's Hulk. You know, there's a director who has people know who that guy is. People know what movies he's made. You know, we can go down the list of other movies he's made. And he makes Hulk, and it's kind of a disaster in a lot of ways. You know, certainly from a public perception of it, it was a disaster, to the point where when they made a sequel, it was more of like a reboot or a relaunch than a real sequel to it.
I agree.
So, but on the other hand, we could think of a lot of movies that didn't work, that just feel like, they do feel sort of, I think what you were saying, sort of like product. You know, they're put together by a bunch of people who are looking to, you know, build the brand of the character and make people aware of this character and make sure that they can buy the T-shirts, the toys. We're going to make a video game. We want to make new comic books, et cetera, et cetera. And they're less interested in it as a sort of filmmaking enterprise unto itself. And I'm sure we can think of a lot of movies like that where they don't feel like a passion project, where, you know, like The Hulk, for all its flaws, there is sort of something interesting to me about it. Because you do feel like the director is trying something, you know what I mean?
He's
not playing it safe, at the very least.
No, I agree.
It may be kind of a mess, but it's sort of an interesting mess, at the very least, to me. Some people might disagree. But you know, like, something that was so interesting to me was that the second Hulk movie, or at least the more recent Hulk movie,
yes,
was more sort of, I think, it was almost like people asked for something, and then they delivered it. But to me, it's like it did seem a little bit more like a product, you know, like this is, you know, here's the Hulk, and he's doing all these, you know, he's breaking stuff. See, he's breaking stuff now. You know, don't look for any Freudian metaphors in this one. Just smashing things. And to me, it was almost like too much in the other direction. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
I feel like the best comic book movies are the ones that kind of, they take the material, they have that sort of, the fun, the adventure, the special effects, all of that looks great. But it also is about characters and story, and maybe a couple of ideas, too. A couple of ideas never hurt anybody. Those are always nice. You know, The Dark Knight was an incredible action movie, but it also had some... You were thinking about things while you were watching it, too, or at least I was. It's not just, wow, that was a really cool gadget, but it had cool gadgets, it had cool stunts. It also had some commentary about America, I thought, you know, so... It's like there's got to be a middle ground. You have to balance it out, and it is tough to do. And maybe that is why we should maybe look at it as more of a a group effort, because they certainly are, at least the ones where it's a superhero movie, they are incredibly huge productions with dozens, if not hundreds, of people working on them.
I agree. And now that's interesting with what you said about the new Hulk movie, the Edward Norton Hulk movie, because I agree with what you say about Ang Lee. It's an interesting failure. And being a movie fan myself, those are also interesting to watch and see what went right and what went wrong. I mean, I feel that way about AI, the film that Spielberg took over from Stanley Kubrick. And it's not a favorite film of mine, but it really was interesting to watch and see at least what I perceive to be the differences of one filmmaker transferring his ideas to another filmmaker. And I thought that was neat. And with Ang Lee and the Hulk, I liked also, you're right, I think there was definitely a character subtext that was there, but also I really liked even some of the visual choices of, you know, some of the split-screen moments that really felt like comic book panels. And I didn't think it was hokey at all. I think he was really trying to visually capture that same feeling that you get reading a comic book, and that you know, you could have different things going on at the same time. And I thought those were interesting visual choices that had nothing to do with CGI, but it really was a filmmaker's choice. So,
right, he was taking chances. He wasn't playing it safe. I think when I saw the second Hulk movie, which I thought was fine, but my reaction was, like I said, it was almost like it was kind of like frustrating for different reasons than the first movie was frustrating. Like, the first movie is Bruce Banner and the second movie is the Hulk. You know, like, the first one is almost too smart and the second one is almost too stupid. You know what I mean? That was sort of my take on it. And you know, this is like personal opinion.
Of course.
But for all the talk about how much the effect, remember how big of a deal the effects were in the first Hulk? Like, people were comparing him to Shrek. I remember before the movie came out, it was like, he doesn't look good. You know, people on the internet were freaking out. Remember this?
You're 100% right. And I think they released too many trailers before the CGI was ready.
Right. And I think if you look at the finished version, now it may not look as, you know, it's a, I don't know, what is it, 7-8-year-old movie at this point. It may not look that great. But I don't think that the second movie looks that much better. I remember sitting there in the theater going, does this look that much better? I mean, it's still a CGI character. You know, I don't know how much more we're convinced that what we're seeing is real. And I, you know, this is another reaction I had to sort of the Hulk franchise in general, is sort of like an overarching problem to the franchise, however good it looks, it is a CGI character who, in the case of the Hulk, doesn't speak. He just kind of, you know, smashes things. So they cast these great actors like Eric Bana and Edward Norton, and then the end of the movie, whatever is going on, it always ends up being a big fight with the Hulk, this character who has no emotions other than just being pissed off at everyone, and doesn't, and in the case of the movie, doesn't speak, doesn't even say really Hulk smash it, you know, maybe once in the whole movie. It's like you build to the big climax, and then it's a character who doesn't speak and doesn't really feel anything. It's almost like the whole sort of enterprise has this sort of like problem to it, this like central problem. At least to me, it's like, I don't know that either movie sort of solve that problem, where we get invested in this actor and then they're replaced by this little CGI character. Whereas in a movie like Iron Man or Spider-Man or Batman, we even if there are moments where the character is replaced completely by computer images, there's an act. We feel like there's an actor there. We can hear their voice. You know, we don't lose them. And I always think of, like, in the Spider-Man movies, they always end with a scene where Peter Parker, or Tobey Maguire, I should say, loses his mask.
Right.
Which is always stupid for a comic book fan, because, like, Spider-Man never loses his mask, right? But on the other hand, we get to see the actor, and we get to see, like, him actually acting, whereas Spider-Man has a mask where you couldn't see his face.
Right.
So it's sort of like, okay, from the fidelity standpoint, that's maybe not like, it's not like the comic books, it's incorrect, but, you know, on the other hand, it's like we're connecting with the character. And I always feel like in those Hulk movies, I can't connect with this computer-generated Hulk, no matter how good it looks.
That's interesting.
You know,
yeah, I hadn't really thought of it in those terms. I kind of like the Edward Norton movie a little bit more than you do, and I thought it worked better, and certainly better than the Ang Lee movie. And I agree that the intellectual hurdle was a lot lower in the second movie. But I also liked Edward Norton's Banner better than I liked Eric Bana's Banner, and I liked.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
Yeah, and I agree with you too, saying that Yeah, I think you're right. You are emotionally cut off from the Hulk. But also, I think at that point, too, no different, maybe in, no differently than a Western or something else, it's time for the action, and it's time for Hulk smash, and you kind of let, you know, the special effects take over at that point of the film, I suppose.
Right.
But, no, that's very interesting. Now, there are a couple guys that and I don't expect you to have the answer to this, but I'm always fascinated by who gets the job to direct these films. Because in the case of Zack Snyder, there's a guy who kind of built his reputation in music video before becoming a feature player. And shame on me for not having it at my fingertips, but I know that the Hellblazer director had also kind of made his mark in videos before getting the assignment.
Right. I think it's Francis Lawrence. That sounds right.
That sounds right. But then, like, there are guys like...
Yeah, that's his name, Francis Lawrence.
There you go. Well, and not to pick on any specific guys, but I am going to throw out some names and probably, you know, not be very nice, but, like, Tim Story getting the Fantastic Four movie. It's like, why did Barbershop make him the right guy for Fantastic Four? It just didn't make sense to me. And
That's a great question. I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know, and conversely, and we're going to see how he does on his second film, but Jon Favreau, I heard him being interviewed by Elvis Mitchell on another fine movie podcast, and the treatment, and I heard Favreau say that he needed to make films like The Elf, or like Elf and Zathura, and really kind of figure out special effects, and even going, he said, back to Swingers, every one of those films informed him and got him prepared to do Iron Man, where he really kind of, as much of a bomb as that thrower was, you know, he learned from that film and from a special effects standpoint. And,
right,
you know,
he got to cut his teeth on the special effects side of filmmaking.
Yep.
Absolutely. I know what you're saying.
Yeah. So I don't know. What were you going to say? I interrupted you when I said Favreau.
Yeah, no, I don't know. You know, it's a really good question. I have no idea how a guy like you, you mentioned specifically Tim Story, like, I honestly don't know how he would, you know, how he lands Fantastic Four, which is such a, would seemingly be like a huge property. You would think could, you know, garner a, you know, like a really big name filmmaker along the lines of a, you know, Sam Raimi. And I'm not, you know, like, I'm not going to bash on Tim. I like Barbershop. I enjoyed that movie when I saw it.
Me too, actually.
It's certainly not the, sure, but it's not the sort of movie where you go, well, that guy should make Fantastic Four.
That's my
point.
It's like, exactly.
How do you get from A to B? And he made this movie Taxi in between the two.
Oh God, Jimmy Fallon and
Queen Latifah.
Oh my God.
The remake of a Luc Besson movie, I think, which I saw, and let's not even discuss it. I think would be probably best for all parties. But that's not. And I guess you could say that was him cutting his teeth on special effects to some degree. I guess
okay.
It's an action movie at least.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I guess you could maybe use that as his, well, that was his sort of, you know, jumping off point, at least from the action film side of things. And maybe what they thought was, well, we need a guy who can tell, you know, something more character-oriented. You know, it's the Fantastic Four. Obviously, we want the characters to really, it's a story about the relationships between these characters. But I don't know that necessarily came off in either of the Fantastic Four movies, unfortunately. But, maybe that was the thinking. I don't know. That's a great question. I really don't know.
Maybe he just gives,
you know, like how much of it is based on, you know, giving a great meeting and giving a great pitch for what you want the movie to be, and whoever is in charge of the movie saying, you know, being sold in the room, as they say, you know, like,
sure.
you know, having a pitch, having a perspective, what you want to do with the movie, and someone saying, yes, that's the movie I want to make.
Something else that I think has changed from the first part of, since 1998, and now as we close out the first decade of the 21st century, I think it's interesting that action films have moved away from that obligatory 140-minute length to let it be as long as it needs to be to tell the story. And not only from the DVD standpoint, but like two cases in point, I would say, would be the Daredevil film with Ben Affleck, Mark Johnson, the director of that, and I mean... I think the director's cut is a marked improvement and a much fuller story, and it was a big mistake to kind of cut it down to the hour 40. And then a non-comic book movie that it reminds me of is the last Star Trek Next Generation film, where I felt like Stuart... I'm blanking now. U.S. Marshals.
Stuart Baird?
Yes, thank you. I think he really was on a mission to make an hour and 40-minute movie rather than really focus on the story a little bit better and say, yeah, you know, we need a little more time to explore these people before you get to everything exploding.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. I actually haven't seen the Daredevil director's cut. I've never seen it. And as a matter of fact, when we were planning to do this this podcast, I actually, that was one of the movies I wanted to see. I tried to see a few things that I hadn't seen before, and that was on my list, and I couldn't get a copy of it. But I've heard from people that it's a better movie that way. So I guess I've got to keep looking for it and check it out, because that's something I've been meaning to see for a while.
Yeah, well, there's a whole Coolio subplot that involves the Kingpin, and it really, I mean, you get more of Matt Murdock in court. You get a better explanation and a more fuller explanation of who the Kingpin is and how he's affecting the city, and it is. It's just a better film. And I mean, again, still with a couple flaws, and you know, it's not. I understand, and it'll be interesting to see when they do reboot Daredevil. It sounds like Fox is planning on rebooting Daredevil at some point. At least now, it's in development, at least. But I think it is worth seeing. I think the director's cut is a better film, and I think it, you know, I think it would satisfy Daredevil fans a lot more than if they just saw the Jennifer Garner love fest that it turned out to be.
Right. You know, one other thing I thought of maybe in terms of this question of how do certain directors get certain jobs, I wonder if part of it could also be kind of getting almost back to your suggestion that perhaps that some of these films are more of a, you know, they're produced, you know, they're made by a group of people instead of just a single vision or a single director or a single author. It makes me kind of think of the Bond franchise where you have producers who are sort of famously controlling of the film, and they often hire directors who, instead of hiring like the guys who always say, you know, you hear these stories about Quentin Tarantino wants to make a Bond movie, or Steven Spielberg's always wanted to make a Bond movie, but they never hire those guys because they would want to take over the movie, and they would want to have final cut, and they would want to have total control, whereas the film producers who, like, it's like a family lineage who controlled this franchise for decades now.
Literally.
They don't ever want to let go of the control, and they always pick the directors that they're going to work with the best. And they've made some, you know, some wonderful Bond movies. I'm a big Bond fan, so I'm not going to, like, I'm not trying to take them to task, but maybe it's a case like that where you have a producer who's not going to hire some director to come in who's going to put their crazy Ang Lee-style spin on things, and they just want a more safe comic book movie.
Well,
maybe.
No, I understand, and I think you're right. In the case of the Bond films, there was, you know, almost 30 years of success. And really was, you know, until the Dalton films were, you know, was kind of creaking along. And then, of course, you know, after Pierce Brosnan had a couple decent movies, there were a couple lousy movies, and it was time for a change. No different than Star Trek, finally taking it away from Gene Roddenberry and Paramount putting new producers in to kind of put new life both in the films and in the television series that came afterwards. So, yeah, no, I can see that. And again, there's an old Hollywood tug of war, producer versus director. I mean, you can go back to David O. Selznick and, you know, the four guys that made Gone with the Wind, and
right,
you know, and even Hitchcock and O. Selznick as well, at you know, the times that they worked together as well on films like Rebecca and things. So I see that. Well, one other thing I wanted to ask about too is I wanted you to kind of come up with a couple films that that are, you know, little hidden favorites of yours that were based on comic books or comic book related films. That may not have been everyone's favorites, but, you know, they hold a guilty pleasure spot in your heart. So I've got a couple as well. I've got three, and I don't know if you were able to come up with three.
I've got, yeah, let me see if I've got three. I've got two that I really feel more strongly about, and then I've got a bunch of other ones. But I can pick one out of the three, yeah.
Well,
do you want to start, or do you want me to start?
I want you to start, and then I'll take one.
Oh, fine, sure, put the pressure on me. Well, I'm gonna start, we've talked about the director a little bit, but I'm going to start with Spider-Man 3. It's a movie that I'm always surprised when I see how much it's insulted and dissed upon on the internet. You know, I feel like it's almost like a punchline that I've seen a lot, especially like when I was reading reviews of like Drag Me to Hell, when people would be like, "Finally," you know, like, "Oh God, Spider-Man 3 was terrible. Thank goodness he's back to form. Sam Raimi is back to form with Drag Me to Hell." And I'm not going to tell you that it's a great movie. It's definitely flawed, very flawed. Obviously, I would say the weakest of the three, the most flawed of the three Spider-Man movies. And maybe it's, I probably should say that I have a dual bias of the fact that I've loved Sam Raimi's films for a long time. One of my favorite filmmakers, if not one of my very favorite, you know, filmmakers, at least working today. And the fact that I'm a huge Spider-Man fan, where if, you know, you ask me who is my favorite character or my favorite, you know, the thing that I've really kind of latched onto my whole life, it would be Spider-Man.
Okay.
So I'm biased. You know, it's like,
that's cool.
I could find something to love probably in the worst Spider-Man movie of all time. But I feel like it's gotten a little bit of a bum rap. Before I go on, I want to know, what do you think about it?
I don't hate it as much as other people, but I thought it kind of suffered in the same way that the Batman franchise did in terms of one hero, one villain. I think that's the best way to go. I think when you spread the story to too many villains that each demand, you know, their portion of the stage. Batman, I think the Nolan Batman films were different. I think they used the villains to a greater effect in both films, actually. That to me was a big problem with Spider-Man. There was just too much going on.
Yeah, I think that absolutely is one of the problems. The whole like one villain thing. I guess I don't know how hard I want to make that rule, because, you know, like you even said, The Dark Knight has two villains, and I love that film.
True.
But in this case, we've got, like, three villains. You've got Venom and the Harry Osborn Green Goblin and Sandman.
Exactly.
You know, to me, like, the Sandman is the guy that has to go to me in that movie. Like, just watching it again, he really has no place in the story whatsoever. He's basically, all he is this incredible special effect. They have, I mean, the effects for him are fantastic. They're incredible to look at. But he really serves no purpose in the story whatsoever. They sort of shoehorn him in. They invent the whole storyline with his relationship to Uncle Ben's murder. and he just does a lot of sort of moping around, where Thomas Hayden Church just has to kind of stand around looking really sullen in that ridiculous T-shirt the whole time. So that's obviously a flaw. I would completely agree with that. I would also agree that I would also say that the sort of the way that they handled the Peter and Mary Jane kind of breakup or the end of their relationship, I feel like was kind of mishandled. And at least it was clumsy. I mean, the way that it sort of slowly breaks apart, it does kind of feel like they felt obligated to do something as opposed to just keeping them together. And they never quite figured out a really convincing way to have them separate. And like I said, having watched the movie again recently, they have the scene where it's like Spider-Man Day.
Yes.
And Peter is kind of basking in the like adulation of the crowd, and he receives his key to the city or whatever it is from Gwen Stacy, and like eggs her on to give him a kiss, which is understandably upsetting to Mary Jane, and it just seems so kind of out of character. That it just seemed like it was something that was thrown in there to kind of to stick the wrench in the relationship, as opposed to something that felt sort of organic. And thinking about it again, I feel like they could have done something with where they've got the whole Venom suit, you know, and its influence on Spider-Man. That by that point in the film, he hasn't sort of been affected by yet. I feel like if you let him start to sort of be kind of more slowly and organically kind of influenced by it or corrupted by it, then it would have made a little bit more sense. But that's not how they chose to do it. Maybe because they had so many characters, they never quite figured out a kind of a smoother plot line. But, I mean, what I do like about it, having said all of that, is some of the stuff that we were talking about with the Ang Lee Hulk, where it doesn't feel like he's making he's asleep at the wheel, just making a safe movie. He's cashing a check. You know, there's a lot of idiosyncratic stuff in Spider-Man 3, some strange things. And maybe they all don't work. But you have to kind of admire the fact that they didn't just make a movie that was designed to be made into a video game at the same time. You know, like,
I agree.
The scene with Bruce Campbell as the maitre d' in the French restaurant, I could watch that scene 1,000 times and never get tired of it. The scene, and all the stuff, too, where Peter Parker becomes evil because of the Venom suit, which is so silly and absurd, and I suppose from one perspective you could say, well, he doesn't really take Venom all that seriously, or at least the effect on the character. On the other hand, those scenes are so fun, and the kind of Sam Raimi Peter Parker is such a square that to me it's so hilarious that the evil Peter Parker is just this guy who walks around. It's like Spider-Man Night Fever, you know, he's like having these like disco fantasies of walking around making googly eyes at women, you know, like, and then getting into this big elaborate dance routine and playing the piano in front of Mary Jane to show her up. It's like so absurd. I really love all those strange, bizarre, inexplicable touches. And then I also think that like the action scenes in the movie are definitely amongst the best of the series. I don't know if you would agree with me there, but
no,
that scene where he has to rescue Gwen and from the crane and the fight at night with Harry with the whole goblin glider snowboarding thing that he uses, which
yep.
is so cool, and the final battle with Sandman and Venom. I mean, the effects are great, the action sequences are great. Not a perfect movie, but I feel like people dump on it unnecessarily. I think that it's got a unfairly bad rap to me.
All right, fair enough. I will go back a couple decades and go to the late 70s and a film that John Ritter starred in called Hero at Large. And in a lot of ways, it's a warmed-over Frank Capra wannabe kind of film. Ann Archer plays his love interest. He's an out-of-work actor that is hired to do a live appearance to support a crappily made superhero film. The hero is called Captain Avenger. And he inadvertently stops a grocery store holdup, a little mom-and-pop shop, in his Captain Avenger outfit, and, you know, kind of becomes this symbol of New York and a little guy, you know, hero that can make a difference in the city. And the powers that be kind of take advantage of what he's able to do and hook his heroics to a mayoral campaign. And it does. It plays a lot like warmed over, you know, Frank Capra. But there's something really charming about it. And also what I like about it is Ritter, you know, learns very quickly that, you know, as fun as it was to, you know, succeed the first time, he's brought down to earth pretty quickly the second time he tries to, you know, do some good in the outfit. And it's good. I can't help it. I mean, I think Ritter is incredibly charming in the film. And I'm a sucker for a Frank Capra kind of man against the system a film like that. And I, you know, just like people like Gary Cooper and Jimmy Stewart and all the best Frank Capra kind of heroes, he's got the best intentions and sees the good in everyone and wants to really be there for the people and thinks that, you know, if the people work together, they can make a difference. And, you know, the fat cats don't always have to win. And, you know, it's like I said, it's kind of inadvertently. There's a little superhero aspect to it. He's in the costume enough, though, and it's cute. It was really this kind of little throwaway film. I can't even remember who directed it, but it is on DVD, and I would say that people would be surprised at how cute it is and how effective it is, and that he comes off very real. And I thought it was a neat little movie.
I've not seen it. I've never even heard of this movie. I've never even heard of this movie. I'm looking it up. 1980, directed by Martin Davidson.
There you go.
The great Martin Davidson.
Yeah, yeah. Who can forget his fine, you know, body of work?
His episode of Judging Amy that he directed was fantastic. He directed Eddie and the Cruisers. So.
Oh wow! Well, there you go. There's a little sleeper hit that he had.
A little respect, a little attention paid to the great Martin Davis.
All right, there we go. Exactly. There's some street cred for him. Exactly.
There you go.
Very
you
funny.
Go.
So.
Well, so it's on DVD. I should check this movie out.
I honestly, yeah. I mean, it's definitely a forgotten movie. It pops up on TV every now and then. I'm sure it's been on Encore a million times. But
For big Bert Convy fans. Like
I was going to say, I forgot about that. Exactly. I mean, if you want an obvious strike one, two words, Bert Convy. but there you go. And yeah, he's one of the slimy fat cats that is like, hey, I think we can, you know, figure out an angle on this Captain Avenger guy. But no, it is. It's a cute movie, and I think it works on a lot of levels.
All right. Now, it's not based on an actual comic book, though.
No, it's not. It's a comic book themed film. So maybe I took license by you.
I think you cheated. I didn't know I could do that because I would have had so many other movies.
Well, because you know there are all these little hidden gem like comic related movies like that. Like actually, one I just saw 2 weeks ago, How to Murder Your Wife is a Jack Lemmon film. With Verna Lisi, and I couldn't even tell you who the director is, but he plays a comic strip cartoonist that does a Secret Agent comic strip. He is a confirmed bachelor. He winds up marrying this beautiful Italian woman and turns the comic strip from a Secret Agent thing into a husband and wife comic strip. It becomes a huge hit. He hates being married. And it's very funny, but the cool thing from a comic book standpoint is Alex Toth did the comic strip art.
Wow.
And yeah, it's...
That one I've heard of, but I haven't seen. I've actually heard... That one I feel... I'm proud to say I've heard of it, at least.
There you go. Attaboy. It's a 60s, yeah. You know, it's a silly 60s kind of swinging 60s kind of movie. I mean, it's not that... I shouldn't say swinging. You know, kind of more Rat Pack than the Carnaby Street of London or, you know, any American comparison or whatever. So yeah, I'd say it's kind of more rooted in like Rat Pack kind of swinging. But
the one I've always wanted to see that I haven't seen, maybe you have, and given who I'm talking to, I'm getting you have, but it's the Martin and Lewis movie where they play comic book artists.
Absolutely.
Artist and model.
Great movie.
I have to see it.
Well,
I love Frank Tashlin. I haven't gotten around to seeing that one.
Well, and why don't you tell people about Frank Tashlin if you know his pedigree?
Well, I mean, he was a guy, I think you're probably more of an expert than I am, but I mean, he got to start doing, maybe not his start, but he made a lot of Warner Brothers cartoons, Looney Tunes, and then kind of graduated to doing live action stuff, a lot of it with Martin and Lewis, and then with Jerry Lewis during his solo career, and stuff like Cinderfella, and The Disorderly Orderly, and all that stuff. Maybe not in fashion to like these movies, but some of them are quite charming.
Well, and effective sight gags too, and I mean a lot of good physical comedy, and also great rock and roll movie, The Girl Can't Help It, amazing early mid-50s Jane Mansfield movie with Little Richard, and just great rock and roll scenes in that film too. But he actually even got his start doing comic strips before he was doing films. So there's, you know, yeah, Artists and Models is amazing, and it also has a lot of scenes that involve the whole, are comic books good for kids? It's sad that that movie's kind of a lost movie. It's not on DVD, and I don't know, you know, how many prints...
I think it actually recently came out on some kind of like a Martin Lawrence. It came out on like a Martin and Lewis box set that they put out, actually.
Oh, awesome.
Just recently.
Oh, I'm thrilled.
I'm pretty sure they have it on like Netflix. I'm not positive. I could check it here while we're talking. But
And people would be
sure that it...
You go ahead.
They have it. I'm going to look it up.
Okay.
Yeah.
While you're looking, I'll just say that, Shirley MacLaine is very young in this film. I mean, it's before The Apartment. It's from the mid or late 50s. And,
yeah.
She's gorgeous in the film. I mean, she's just crazy pretty.
Netflix has it. Yeah, it's on some sort of some sort of double feature disc from this Martin and Lewis collection.
Oh, fantastic!
So, yeah, there you go. It's in my queue actually right now. I just gotta.
Oh man,
watch it.
I gotta pick that up. That's gonna be great. But yeah, it's great. And yeah, they write and draw a character called the Bat Lady, that you know, definitely is kind of a combination of Batman and I would say Phantom Girl, because there's definitely a high cheesecake kind of quotient to the character, and Shirley MacLaine plays the model that they draw. It's pretty neat. No, it's a typical Martin and Lewis film, but there's a lot of good humor in it and a lot of comic book humor that I definitely think fans would appreciate.
All right, well, I have to check that one out. Should I move on to my second?
By all means.
My second movie? Maybe not quite as obscure as Spider-Man 3. I know I was tasked to pick out obscure, underseen gems. But, I mean, you would pose it as, you know, also like, you know, flawed movies that we like. So
yeah.
That was where that came from.
Yeah.
This one is a little more underseen. It's still recent. I'm not, you know, it's not from the late 1950s or 60s, but... It's 2006, the movie Art School Confidential. Have you seen it?
No, you know, I've been meaning to see it, so please tell me about it.
It's a movie that, again, I feel like was kind of underappreciated. Here, it's a case where it seems like, you know, a lot of people didn't see it either, but those who saw it, I don't know, I didn't appreciate it, didn't enjoy it as much as I did. It's directed by Terry Zwigoff, who did Ghost World and Crumb, so
yes.
And Bad Santa, which is not a comic book movie, but is
damn funny
of mine.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites too.
And you know, it's funny when thinking about all those movies he's made. He's kind of like the forgotten comic book movie director. I mean, we don't think of him in that way, but when you've made Crumb and Art School Confidential and Ghost World, I think we maybe have to talk about him in that sense. He just makes different, you know, different kinds of comic book movies.
Absolutely.
But Art School Confidential, it's based on a short story by Daniel Clowes of the same name. The story has, it's only like 6 pages, something like that. It doesn't, I don't even think it has an actual narrative. It's more of just observations from his time at art school and how much he hated everyone there. And the movie, which he also wrote, he wrote the screenplay for the movie, sort of takes those observations and then layers them into this story of this kind of gifted, talented artist who's played by Max Minghella, and his model, ironically enough, given the movie we were just talking, who's played by Sophia Miles. And basically, he goes to art school, he wants to be the next great artist, he has all these sort of, he's idealistic, he's naive, he has all these dreams, and then he gets to art school, and basically, it's this horrible place with all these horrible people, and I didn't go to art school. I went to first to communication school. You know, I got a degree in communications, and then I studied like film studies, not filmmaking, but film studies. And a lot of, but regardless, a lot of the sort of world of the art school, of class discussions, of which there are several of them in the movie, it really struck me as a very truthful movie. Now, it's cynical, it's dark, it's mean-spirited. You know, if you have to know that it's that sort of movie. If you've seen Bad Santa, you know the kind of humor that Terry Zwigoff is into. So it's not going to be like a chipper movie. It's pretty dark. Layered into this sort of story of his first year at art school is also this fairly ridiculous, and one of the flaws of the movie to a lot of people, this murder mystery that's going around the campus. Basically, these young women are being murdered, and that gets like basically weaved into the story in various ways, and a lot it kind of becomes more and more prominent as you go along, and it's a big part of the ending. And a lot of people really kind of rejected how sort of conventional and at times a little ridiculous the murderer psycho killer aspect of the movie is, and I can see that. But to some degree, the movie is about. It's about like taste and convention, and there's this character that's played by Ethan Suplee, who is a film student, and a lot of his character kind of gets wrapped up in how we react to this murder mystery serial killer subplot. And I find watching it when I watched it multiple times that it kind of speaks to his character and to the themes of how we interpret art and what people want out of art, because a lot of it is whether people are in the art world because they really are genuinely artistic or have the need to express themselves, or are they looking to get laid, or are they looking to make a lot of money, and how do they react when people don't like their work, or how do they react when they like other people's work that seems inferior to their own. And I think it's a really funny movie. I think it's an insightful movie. It's a little mean-spirited, but that's kind of the way I like a lot of my comedy. I'm not afraid of that. I enjoy that. And I think that there's some truthfulness to it. And I think it's a movie that's worth checking out. Really good performances from the supporting characters, too. John Malkovich is like the main teacher, who's hysterically funny. Jim Broadbent is this character who's sort of he's sort of the dark vision of what the main character could become. He's this guy. He went to the same art school, and now he lives in his apartment drinking his life away. He's miserable. He hates his life, and he says at one point, describing his disgusting apartment, when the Max Minghella character is told what he went to the same school, and he goes, "Just look at me now," and like you know, puts up his arms and like you know, showing off his disgusting apartment. Also, a really good sort of like one scene cameo from this guy, Adam Scott. You might not know who that is by name. Did you see Step Brothers? John?
No, I haven't. That's funny. No, I was talking about that film today. Go ahead.
Well, you'll have to see it. He plays the other brother in Step Brothers. Will Ferrell's like actual brother in Step Brothers.
And I see.
He's one of the best people around right now playing just like absolute douchebags. He's fantastic douchebag. And I know if he was listening, he would know what I mean and take it as a compliment.
I understand.
He plays the sort of success story who's from the school. The flip side of the Jim Broadbent character, who comes back to counsel the students on what their lives could become. And basically when students ask him, you know, how do you see art transforming in the 21st century, he says things like, shut up, that's a stupid question, I don't want to answer it. You know, and then this, you know, will go on about, all you really people care about is how to turn yourselves into me. How do you become me? You know, like, and the answer is, you just have to be me. You can't become me. And all this sort of stuff. It's just really one or maybe even two scenes in the movie, but really funny. And I enjoy his supporting performances in a bunch of movies. So if you haven't seen it, I do recommend it. Maybe you won't like it as much as I do.
No, honestly, I do want to see it. I just haven't seen it on cable and haven't made time to go out and get it. I love Ghost World. I mean, Ghost World really, and Crumb on its own. I mean, my God, what an amazing documentary. And you know, just incredible. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have, you know, seen it. Ghost World, too. And, you know, Ghost World was really the first film I saw after 9/11. And
really?
Yeah. And also, I think we know enough douchey, like, just any type of pop culture doucheyness. I think you can find TV and film snobs. I mean, everything like that. I think there are examples of
right.
that. So, yeah, I can...
It's not just douchiness, too. One of the things that I think the movie gets really right is the way, and it's very true almost of the, I feel like, of the internet a lot of times, too, is like the groupthink that takes over.
Sure.
One person says something, and everyone does. No one wants to disagree. No one wants to be the one person who disagrees. And everyone sort of joins in and agrees, and then the one person who does disagree gets called names and ostracized. And the movie, that's a big part of the movie, and I feel like it's totally truthful and really kind of nailed in this really smart way in the movie.
Very cool. Now, I got another movie for you. You know Mario Bava?
Yes, I know who it is. Yes.
Okay.
I've heard of him.
One of the Italian directors of the 60s and, you know, certainly made his share of spaghetti westerns, but made a very neat film based on an Italian comic book that I've only had limited experience, you know, reading, but the film is great. It's called Danger Diabolique. He's a bad guy, but he's kind of a Robin Hood kind of bad guy who fights the system, steals for the rich, for his own gain. What part of it really amazes me, and you learn this from the commentary, is Bava was able to, using very little money, come up with some pretty amazing special effects and literally just force perception and, you know, cars disappearing into what looked like secret caverns and things that really is, they were, you know, just your eyes playing tricks on you and him knowing how to use the camera. It's this very cool late 60s film, great action. I know it's John something Law. I believe Law was his
name. John Philip Law.
It is John Philip Law. Thank you. Who just died a couple of years ago. And he does the commentary on the DVD. And it's great. In fact, the Beastie Boys made a video kind of based on the film and actually used footage from the film. I forget which song it is specifically. But
I haven't seen the video. I've seen this as part of Mystery Science Theater. Wasn't this the very final episode of Mystery Science Theater?
You know, I think you're right.
Did that offend you? It sounds like
no,
you,
not
you
at all.
Enjoy this movie as a genuine movie. You're not sitting there. This is not like something you enjoy ironically or laughing at it.
You
enjoyed this movie.
I did, and I, you know, first of all, I love Mystery Science Theater, and also no film is too precious, you know, in my book. I mean, that's
right.
You know, nothing is sacred ground. I mean, I do get angry when great movies are remade poorly, like Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, for example.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, it's an Italian film. It's definitely, you know, it's dubbed. There are histrionics in the film that are, you know, very easy to make fun of. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. But it really is interesting because it comes from that Batman, Adam West era. And I just think visually really kind of went in interesting directions. It's a cooler 60s film. It's like if you take Batman and say Matt Helm or you know, the goofier aspects of James Bond and throw it together, I think you have a very interesting film here.
I have one other, I've never seen it without Mystery Science Theater, but I have one other connection to the movie, which is I used to work at this video store in New York called Kim's Video, which is sadly now closed. It was kind of a legendary indie video store in New York.
Cool.
And worked there, and one day Paul Pope, the artist, came in, and I recognized him because I had met him at conventions, you know, just as a fan, you know,
cool.
Getting books signed and stuff. And he was looking for Diabolique. I don't know. I got to talk to him a little bit, just briefly, saying, you know, you know, that kind of thing. I had a little moment, but I don't remember what he said he wanted to watch it for, maybe just general inspiration, but he came in and that was specifically the movie he was looking for, and thankfully we did have it. I didn't have to send him away, but
that's
the other
cool
thing that it makes, yeah, very cool. The other thing that makes me think of is one of my all-time favorite Mystery Science Theater episodes is also about a bad superhero movie. This one, I don't think, based on any actual comic book. And I'm not sure if you've seen this one. I don't think it's been put out on one of their official DVD collections, called The Puma Man.
Yes, indeed.
You haven't seen the Puma Man? That, to me, is one of the all-time classic bad movies. If you're a fan of, cheesy, if you liked Batman and Robin, you'll love The Puma Man. That's probably the best way to put it. You know what I mean? Like, it's that level of stupidity.
Yeah.
And just an ineptness. And it's about this hero. He's got, God, it's been a while. This one I haven't revisited in a couple years now, but he's the Puma Man, and for some reason his powers involve seeing the world, like, in red vision. It's like he sees the world almost, like, the whole world looks like it's a dark room, you know? It's like all red.
Yep.
I don't know, and traveling through walls and flying. What any of those things have to do with being a puma, I don't know. And then the villain is Donald Pleasance, who can't pronounce the hero's name. He's calling him, like, Puma Man and Puma Man. And he gets trouble with the word Puma Man.
I remember that.
To very amusing effect. So I actually think I have a copy of the movie on VHS that I bought that doesn't have Mystery Science Theater. It's so funny. You don't need help to watch that movie in any way.
That's
so
awesome.
That's another one. Maybe that should just be my third one. That's probably a better one than any of the other heavily flawed movies I could think of. That's really, really funny. I'm pretty sure it's not out on DVD, so that one might be hard to find. But if you can find it, oh, man, that is one funny movie.
God, I'm with you, and I really wish that, you know, somebody was running Mystery Science Theater, because that show was so fantastic. And
I've often wondered why. It must have to do with the rights to show all those movies.
Yeah, probably. And I can think of a lot of, you know, film people who own the rights to those films, that when they found out that Mystery Science Theater was making fun of them and stuff, I think immediately, like, filed the cease and desist letters and stuff. And
well, what they did was, I've interviewed some of those guys on a couple occasions, and what happened was that they were victims of their own success, because suddenly these movies that they could get, you know, they could get the rights to do it so cheaply in the beginning because no one wanted them.
Sure.
Suddenly they showed the value in these terrible movies. Not just on Mystery Science Theater, you could release, you know, like, there, you've seen these box sets of, like, schlocky movies that advertise the fact that they're so bad. You know,
yes.
Like, it sprouted this whole cottage industry around bad movies, where, like, suddenly these crummy movies had value. So it was harder and harder to get movies that they could afford, basically. You know, when Mystery Science Theater would want a movie, they would, you know, suddenly it became more valuable.
Have you seen any of the new stuff that they do, the Rift Tracks and Titanic?
Cinematic Titanic. I've seen a couple Cinematic Titanics. I think they're great. I haven't watched a full Rift Tracks yet, just because I haven't gotten around to it. A lot of the movies that they have, I don't have the DVDs for.
Okay.
You have to, and so I haven't kind of gotten to the trouble. I need to do it. I really want to do a couple of them, actually. There's one that I do have that I want to hear them talk about, this movie, The Room. I don't know if you've heard about
this
whole movie, The Room.
Yes, indeed.
Which I'm happy to say I own on DVD. I need to do that one. but I haven't done it. They had that other sort of enterprise that they did for Rhino, or one of those companies called the Film Crew, and I own a bunch of those as well. But that was, I guess, shorter lived than their this Rift Tracks thing, which they've been doing for a while now.
Yeah, and I really like, you know, it's funny, I've been trying to get, like, Kevin Murphy or somebody from Rift Tracks to come on, and I'd love to talk to those guys, because they've had an interesting career, and I give them a lot of credit for figuring out a way of continuing to do this. And you know, I hope they're able to continue, because I saw Star Trek V. With the Rift Tracks guys doing it. It was hilarious. It was great.
Yeah.
You know, they're very, very funny. Well, I guess my last movie, and I'll go a little more mainstream, I'll plead the case for Dick Tracy.
That was one of the ones that was on my my short list of possibilities. So go ahead. I want to make the case. Let's see what you got.
I think it was funny. I think it was intended to be the comedy that it was. And I honestly think it was. I think Al Pacino, it's one of the funniest roles he's ever had as Big Boy Caprice.
Yeah.
And,
it's sort of the forgotten, crazy Al Pacino role. Everyone talks about The Devil's Advocate.
Yes.
And Heat. People seem to have forgotten the Dick Tracy one, which maybe, you're right, maybe the craziest of them all.
You know, obviously, I think it did well enough, and certainly it helped by having Madonna in the film. And, yeah, she's probably the weak link in the film as Breathless Mahoney. I mean, she looked great, and that's fine. But, man, I'll tell you, I thought, and, God, Dustin Hoffman as Mumbles. I think every bad guy was pretty well cast. That's the thing, and I've interviewed Max Collins, who wrote the Dick Tracy comic strip from the 70s through the early 80s, and he was an advisor on the film. They paid attention. I mean, that's the thing. If you're a Chester Gould fan and a Dick Tracy fan, you should appreciate that film because they did a really good job. And also, those incredibly vivid, bright colors, for me, it worked.
It's one that, I don't know the source material very well. I haven't really myself read a lot of Dick Tracy. It is a really good-looking movie, especially in terms of the colors, like you mentioned. It's a beautiful-looking movie. It is also one of those movies, and it's close to Batman in terms of time, so I don't know how much it could have been influenced by the look of Batman, but it looks an awful lot like Batman.
I agree.
It's one of those movies where you go, well, clearly they were trying to be like Batman a little bit, because Batman's the year before,
right?
Obviously a huge hit. So it would be, be silly not to try to, capture a little bit of that success. Given that it's so close in terms of time, I don't know how much you could be inspired, but it does look an awful lot like Batman. The city itself, kind of resembles it a lot.
Sure.
In a more colorful way, obviously. But the design sort of feels like it. And the other sort of problem, although I agree, it's a fun movie. And the Al Pacino performance is phenomenal. If you want a big Al Pacino performance, where he's screaming and if not eating the scenery, he's destroying it with his mouth and spitting it back out. It's like just devouring things. That's a good place to get it. The thing that is kind of another knock, and maybe you tell me, because like I said, I don't know the Dick Tracy comics very well, is that character of the kid from the strips, from the original strips at all?
Yeah, Junior was the character, yeah.
Because to me, it's like the kid sidekick is like the... That's like the dregs. I mean, any movie with a kid sidekick, it's a problem. It's like an automatic red flag. You can do it well, but it's already kind of like, oh, that's what they're trying to give the kid something to sort of identify with and latch on to.
Sure.
And so I'm always a bit, especially, when I was a kid, I thought it was great. I didn't notice. But now when I watch it, it feels a little like a ploy, you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
This is how we're going to hook the kids. Especially on somebody like Dick Tracy, who they don't know the way they know Batman. Like every kid knows Batman. I didn't really know who Dick Tracy was before the movie. My dad would say, oh, Dick Tracy, sure. And I'd go, I don't know.
No, it's, and Junior, the great thing about comic strips as opposed to comic books is they are allowed to get older. The characters are allowed to get older. And Junior ended up becoming an adult in the Tracy comic strip. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy. The Tribune Company, especially when it got close to, I think, the 70th anniversary of Tracy in the early 2000s, was flirting with the idea of reimagining Tracy as a straight-up police drama that they were going to syndicate as a television series. And suddenly Warren Beatty appeared and had his option in his hand and said, it's still my character until I decide whether I'm going to make a sequel or not. And, really kind of shut down the Tribune's plans to reboot Tracy. Can we talk a little bit about the films that are coming up next year, or at least that are in production now? I don't know how much.
Yeah, you have a list of them? Sure.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to name some of the films right now off the top of my head, some things that are coming up that we're all aware of. Certainly Jonah Hex, Late Summer. We all know about Iron Man 2. Have you heard anything about any of the specific comic films that are...
Well, we can start with Jonah Hex, a guy, that's a character, again, that I don't know all that much about. Like, I haven't read a lot of Jonah Hex comic books. But the thing that would get me excited about that movie is the writers, and I would be more excited if they were the directors, but the writers of that movie are those guys, Neville Dean and Taylor. Do you know these gentlemen?
No, tell me about them.
They made a little film called Crank, and another little film called Crank 2, High Voltage.
Big fan, absolutely.
Two movies that I hold quite dear to my heart. Those are... They're obviously they're B movies, they're action movies, but I think that those guys, they're smarter than they're given credit for, and I think that those movies are incredibly well made, both of them. They're very different, even though, ironically, given that they have the exact same central gimmick in both times, they managed to make two very different movies out of them, and they're very different, but I like them a lot, both of them.
Me too.
What was the Gamer also. Not as good as the two Crank movies, in my opinion, but also worthy, and has one scene in particular that is one of my favorite scenes of any movie I've seen this year. I don't know if you saw Gamer.
No, but now that I know that it's the Crank guys that wrote it, I kind of want to see Gamer.
Well, they wrote it and directed that one as well.
Cool.
Jonah Hex, I think they just wrote. They didn't direct. I think at one point they were supposed to direct it and had some sort of, creative differences or whatever happened, and they fell out of the project. But Gamer has an incredible sequence where the bad guy who's, now I'm blanking on his name. What's the name of the guy who plays Dexter on TV?
Not Jason Gedrick. What the hell's his name? I know who you're talking about.
Michael C. Hall.
Yes, Michael C. Hall.
So Michael C. Hall is the villain, and he's, you saw the trailers, I'm assuming, for Gamer.
Yes.
You know the basic premise and everything. You can, these soldiers are controlled by people with video, so it's like a real-life video game sort of. People play as these people, so they can be controlled, physically controlled. So there's this whole elaborate musical number / fight scene where the Michael C. Hall character is controlling all these people and beating up Gerard Butler's character and also doing a dance number. Phenomenal, amazing, and both visually amazing and also just sort of interesting in the way that it sort of shows you the similarities between the two things, the way that they're both choreographed and the way they're both structured, and just a great, great scene. The whole movie is, in general, fun. I don't think it's quite it's not quite up to the Crank standards. But in any event, if people are listening haven't seen those movies, especially the first Crank, really check that out. It's I feel like they have, we could do a whole podcast on video game movies, of which there's almost no good ones. I feel like without actually making an actual video game based movie, those are the guys that have sort of taken sort of the ideas of video games and actually managed to turn some of them into interesting concepts in movies. I feel like they're some of the few guys who've been able to do that. But in any event, I would be interested to see their Jonah Hex just because, like I said, all their movies are so focused on video games and technology and kind of very contemporary, very modern. So the idea of them doing a Western kind of fascinates me. So I'm sort of disappointed we won't get to see what a Neville Dean Taylor Western looks like. But that said, I'm still curious to see the movie, especially because Josh Brolin is a guy
absolutely
who I've really, in the last couple of years, come to like a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And, No Country for Old Men, which is, I love, what was my favorite movie of that year.
Agreed.
I felt, it was really like a Western in a lot of ways. So
absolutely.
I feel like he's just a perfect kind of Western hero for me.
No, I agree. That was perfect casting. No, I completely agree.
So I don't know how hideously disfigured he's going to look like the character.
Well, the makeup of Two-Face in Batman in The Dark Knight made me feel like that they've at least got a handle where to start.
That's true, and that did look spectacular, actually. It looked really kind of creepy and convincing. And it even had that kind of exposed teeth thing, didn't it?
Exactly. And, I'm a huge fan of the comic, and not only what Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti are doing every month currently, but also going back to Tony DeZuniga and John Albino, given now that I know that, it's the Crank guys that are behind it. But
I don't know how much of their original idea will wind up being in the movie.
Sure.
But at least at Comic-Con, when they were doing the press for it, they were still credited as the writers of it, at least. So I never really, Western comics, I'm sort of like a comic book legacy guy. Like, my dad got me into comic books. He had a whole bunch when he was a kid. A lot of them got sort of thrown away tragically a lot, we would have had this comic and this comic and this comic, and they were, grandma threw them out, unfortunately.
I understand.
The ones that survived, he kind of he passed on to me, and I got into Spider-Man watching The Electric Company, actually. I used to watch. That was how I got into Spider-Man. But in any event, the ones he gave me were all, he was a real big Justice League fan. That was his thing.
That's cool.
So a lot of them were superhero stuff. He didn't really have any Western or war comics, really. So
okay,
that was, I guess, where my taste lies. But I've read some of the modern Jonah Hex ones, and they're great. I agree, they're great. But not exactly, I wouldn't call myself an expert. But you got Josh Brolin, and you have those guys involved. It makes me want to see the movie for sure.
Now, we're certainly hearing a lot about Iron Man 2, and we're hearing a lot about, Thor. It sounds very interesting, Kenneth Branagh doing Thor. And especially, have you seen many of his Shakespeare films, Branagh?
I mean, I have. I wouldn't call myself I'm not really an expert on Jonah Hex or Kenneth Branagh's Shakespeare films. Those are the two sort of things that I'm not, I don't consider myself an expert on.
Well, I haven't seen them all either, but one in particular that I did see was Henry V. And I think, based on that, I am excited about Thor. And also, you know, talking to Brian Bendis and also reading his tweets and every time he does pop up on the message board and gives us a little, you know, clue. In fact, this week as we're recording, they just announced casting for the Warriors 3 characters in Thor. And, I mean, on paper, Anthony Hopkins as Odin, I mean, it sounds like every move they're making, you know, is a good move. And very interesting that it seems like, you know, Asgard and the whole Norse mythology is very much going to be part of it, and that it's going to look a lot and sounds a lot like 300. Other than 300, there aren't that many, you know, kind of epics in the classic sense.
It does sound ambitious. It does sound interesting. I've been following some of those tweets you're referring to. I think Bendis was actually tweeting earlier today about it, that he was walking around the sets. I think he used the phrase that he was, like, inside Odin's chamber or something like that. It sounded incredibly dirty. But,
yeah.
horrifying, but
I saw your response to that. Absolutely, yes,
yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly what he meant, but Thor is another character who, for me, I again not like the biggest Thor fan.
Okay,
but what I'm interested, I always liked. I don't know. It seems like there's been times when he's less grounded in that in a sort of human world and more set in an Asgardian kind of mystical universe. And I've always been more interested in the ones where he's sort of connected to Donald Blake or one of the human characters. Just for me, that take has always been more interesting, the more kind of human grounded side of it. But you're right. There is the Kenneth Branagh choice is a really interesting one, and I there are some similarities there between the mythology of Thor and some of the stuff he's done, and to the point where I'm interested to see his sort of spin on things, and you worry that it maybe could be a little, you know, too serious, but you could also say the reverse and say that he's going to take it so seriously that you're going to, you know, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be a really serious, badass Thor movie.
Maybe it'll be like Brazil. You know, I mean, look at what Gilliam was able to do in those, you know, few winged kind of scenes of Jonathan Pryce kind of, you know, daydreaming and being the hero in his dreams, and that there will be, you know, at the same time, a very grounded Donald Blake story along with all the Asgardian stuff.
Something tells me it'll look a little more expensive than Brazil. I have a weird feeling. Just a hunch I have. As much as I love Brazil, I mean, and I know exactly those scenes you're talking about, which are fantastic, but correct me if I'm wrong, those were literally done with, like, cotton balls and a miniature motorized guy on a string, I think, was actually how they did
probably.
That.
Probably. So. Yeah, probably. But, you know, that's, you got to love Terry Gilliam, man. I mean, you know.
It's one of my favorite movies. It's a great movie. But,
me too.
What we were saying is that the sort of the spirit will be there, if not the specific visual sort of style.
I hear you. Now, speaking of the spirit, because this occurred to me, we didn't talk about this at all. What will Frank Miller's future be like in Hollywood? And you tell me, because you're closer to the, you know, film world. From that kind of failure, is there a future, or is it, you know, yeah, thanks, Frank, see you later?
Well, I don't know. Are they really doing Sin City 2? Is that happening, or is that something that's less likely to actually happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess until that does finally materialize, I guess it depends on Rodriguez's schedule. Because it seems
right.
like
I
that's
like
what's...
That's, I feel like if that doesn't happen, I really don't know what sort of future he could have, you know, in Hollywood. If he gets to make that and it's a hit like the first Sin City,
sure,
then maybe all is forgiven. But yeah, that the spirit could be... That's going to be a tough one to come back from. It would be for anybody, right? But
yeah. Well, you know, I was surprised that, you know, and don't get me wrong, I don't think the movie was that big of a hit. But when I saw that Joel Schumacher was doing that number 23 film, I'm like, oh, my God, they're letting Joel Schumacher make a new movie? I was stunned. Because, honestly, well, I thought he had really failed pretty badly with the Batman franchise and had kind of fallen off the map. But maybe I'm wrong.
Right. Well, but in that case, you know, a guy like Joel Schumacher had made a lot of movies before that and had a bunch of hits. You know, so it's like easier to forgive when you've made a bunch of movies and had one or two flops than it is when you've really only made two movies, only one of which you made by yourself, one of which was like co-directing, and I don't know how much of it he actually directed, you know.
I hear you.
And you make the one movie and it's kind of a notorious flop. I don't know. I mean, you know, Joel Schumacher had a long career before he ever got to Batman.
True.
And had a bunch of movies that were, you know, popular, and people still, you know, people still talk about The Lost Boys to this day.
Good point.
So I think he had maybe a little more leeway, you know what I mean?
I understand. And,
he hasn't had a, it's not like he's had a, you know, he's been super busy, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you come back from The Spirit. I don't know. And the other thing is that, you know, Batman and Robin, as silly as it was, it didn't bomb that badly. You know, it still made a decent amount of money. Whereas,
okay.
I don't know that we could say that about the Spirit.
What about the comic book filmmakers? Which ones have you had a chance to interview, and what kind of insight have you found from, if any of the ones, you know, have you had the chance to talk to, and what have you learned from them?
I don't know that I've learned a whole, you know, unfortunately, a whole lot. I mean, I've interviewed some of them briefly, but, you know, it's like we were saying at the beginning of the podcast, is that when I'm doing these sorts of interviews, a lot of times it's at Comic-Con when they're basically just, you know, pimping out their new movie.
Sure.
And they're not really there to talk about film style and, you know, their point of view. They're there to, you know, just, they want to just promote, you know?
Yeah.
So
no, I understand.
Unfortunately, while I would love to do it, I don't know that I've really gotten to get into really in depth with a lot of these filmmakers. I mean, I've definitely interviewed a lot of them on red carpets and, you know, in various places, and, you know, briefly. These interviews we're talking, though, you know, not like it's not like a Word Balloon interview. They're like, you know, 5 minutes. They're 5 minutes max sometimes.
Oh, so, I hear you, man.
You know, I've literally had interviews where they told me they were going to be like 2 minutes and 45 seconds. I mean, how do you even like introduce yourself to a person in 2 minutes and 45 seconds?
Man.
Let alone do an interview, which I've had to do. It's not easy.
I hear you. And I did the Watchmen press junket they had at WonderCon. Not only in terms of, yeah, you've only got 5 minutes with these people, but the PR person that is constantly tugging your sleeve as you've asked your second question to wrap it up, you know,
the person, people probably don't know that when you're doing those junket interviews that there's people in the room sitting next to, usually they're sitting like right out of camera, you know, in your eye line, distracting you and giving you hand signals in terms of how much time you have left.
Yep.
And giving you wrap-it-up signals or one-minute-left signals or whatever it is. You can see the people just trying to desperately kind of, like, claw every bit of information out of them. But, yeah, I guess there are some similarities there between the that and particularly, like, the red carpet interviews where you're under such a time crunch and it can be really difficult. And, in the same way, the stars there aren't really interested in giving you any sort of real revealing or interesting information. They're really just there to kind of like stay on their talking points, you know, of whatever
sure.
they want to talk about while they're there, you know.
Well, as we wrap up, folks listening now, if you haven't heard Matt's IFC News podcast and Allison, what's Allison's name, your co-host?
Allison Wilmore, yeah, is the co-host.
You guys are great. You guys have a great chemistry about you. I enjoyed your San Diego coverage. I was telling you today that I also listened to a couple recent podcasts, one this week's one where you guys were looking at John Woo, and a few weeks ago I really enjoyed the Twilight Zone episodes. Everyone's your both of your favorite Twilight Zone episodes. That was very entertaining.
We were talking earlier about I guess it was the Hulk and other movies that we liked that try. They may not be perfect, but you admire the ambition involved, and that was the our podcast sort of each week is inspired. We do a topic that's sort of inspired by something that's coming out in theaters. And that the Twilight Zone was specifically inspired by the Richard Kelly movie, The Box, which by the time people listen to this, it will probably be already gone from theaters, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But that was a movie that I enjoyed for that same thing. It was like, man, there was a guy who was just going for broke. He didn't care if you were coming along for the ride or not. He went all out and, I really enjoyed that movie a lot. I admired the sort of person who would make that sort of movie. His big chance to make a big Hollywood, you know, movie, and he makes the biggest, wild, confusing, you know, I'm not going to explain anything sort of mess. I think other people have used this term before, but I've picked it up myself because I enjoy it. Kamikaze auteurism, where you're just like, you don't care what anyone says, you're just going to do it. You're just going to, you know, destroy your career if that's what it takes. You're just going to make the movie you want to make. And there's a bunch of people who have done stuff like that. And Richard Kelly is a guy who, you know, with Southland Tales.
Yes.
and with the box, you know, he's not afraid to make something uncommercial and just follow his bliss, so to speak.
Well,
and,
I'll be curious to see
that.
how long does the Donnie Darko goodwill last?
That's a great question. Who knows? I mean,
you know?
This was his big kind of like, I get to make a movie in Hollywood. And in fact, at Comic-Con, they were there with the box. That was one of the movies that we covered at Comic-Con. And we did one of those red carpet kind of interviews. And he said to me there something along the lines of, you know, like, I can't just live on the Donnie Darko name forever. I've got to make movies that make some money for people, or I'm not going to get to keep making movies. And given a chance like this, I've got to make something a little more mainstream, a little more commercial. And sure, the box has some movie stars in it, but it is not a mainstream commercial movie at all. It is very strange and goes to some very strange places. So, you go, wow. Well, I admire you. No one would ever call the box a sellout. That's for sure. You did not sell out. What's the opposite of selling out? Whatever the opposite of selling out is, he refused to put anything on sale. He didn't even put the item up for sale. He put it on layaway in the back room.
Well, I want to, man, I'll tell you, we're at 90 minutes, so I'll wrap up with you now. But I do hope you come back, Matt, because I think there's more to talk about. And also, as the digital world continues to evolve from a media standpoint, I wonder how many of these failed filmmakers in the big studio system will find success, you know, really going to real guerrilla filmmaking, and, you know, how far away we are from something, you know, coming out online and really making a statement from a film standpoint without ever having to deal with studios, let alone theaters, and still make an interesting film.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to do it again at some point. We didn't even talk about comic books. We talked about movies. That's what I do all the time. I thought we were going to talk about comic books.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. There you go.
No, I'm kidding. Another time. Yeah, we'll have to do another time. We didn't talk about movies of this year. We didn't talk about any of the movies that came out this year, actually. So, yeah.
No, that's
we'll
all right.
Do it again at some point.
Okay, please. I hope you do come back, man. And thanks, honestly. It's been a pleasure talking to you online. It's now a pleasure talking to you on the phone. And I want to stretch beyond the usual word balloon topics. So I'm happy to have this kind of conversation with you, and look forward to more.
Great, thank you, John. Thank you very much.
This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Funimation and their latest feature, Evangelion 1.01. You're not alone. The movie is the complete rebuild of the groundbreaking sci-fi giant robot anime. Imagine having Dr. Frankenstein as your father. Your classmate and fellow pilot is a partial clone of your dead mother, and she's hot. You've been forced by your father to pilot a giant living robot named Ava Unit 01 to fight deadly creatures called angels from destroying the planet. And to top it off, you have raging teenage hormones, and it's the end of the world if you screw up. No pressure. Otaku USA Magazine writes that Evangelion reminds us of what anime can be by having us flex all our okaru muscles, yet always satisfies our basis needs for cute girls and mecha. You can watch the first 8 minutes of the movie online at Funimation.com/EVANGELION. That's Funimation.com/Evangelion. Evangelion 1.01, You're Not Alone. It's available now on DVD. So there you go, interesting discussion with IFC News film critic and podcast host Matt Singer. Certainly we didn't have all the answers, and I'm very interested in your input as well. So feel free to email me or leave your comments at wordballoon.com. I'm very curious to hear what you think about some of the subjects and people that we discussed today. In fact, last week's conversation with Matt Wagner inspired some comments. Wagner made the observation he believes most heroes work best in the era for which they were created. The Lone Ranger as a Western hero, same with Zorro. Batman and Superman, he feels, work best in the late 30s and early 40s. Some Word Balloon listeners had different opinions. MC Doom found it interesting enough to link to the show via his website, doomcough.com. And B.W. Hancock says, I'll disagree with Matt because Batman and Superman have survived for 70 years. These characters have survived because they've evolved. As long as that next generation of creators that want to create stories for Superman and Bats, they will evolve in whatever the modern world will be. Another listener, Jeff Nelson, wrote me an email and said that he really enjoyed the conversation with Matt. He likes Matt Wagner so much, and he sounded so sincere about his Zorro work that now he feels like he has to check it out. And at the wordballoon.com message boards, Quantum Comic creator Phil Clark says that he enjoyed the conversation with Matt and says that it was probably his favorite interview that I've done this year. Very kind, Philip. Thank you. So if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can either reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. You can also Twitter me at John Word Balloon, or leave a post at wordballoon.com right underneath this episode or any others that you hear, and you might hear your own comments here on the show. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. John Suntress reminding you that if you're not a subscriber to Word Balloon, feel free to do so. You can do that by going to wordballoon.com or subscribing via iTunes. December's going to be another big month for Word Balloon. Keep listening. More new episodes are on the way. Until next time, thanks a lot. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.